Welcome, everyone. I will call the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue to order. Before we get going today, I just want to let people know that we are going to carry over to the Wednesday agenda the Senate Bill 1519 and Senate Bill 1531. We still have a possible chance of getting amendment in for Senate Bill 1529, which was heard last Friday. So we will start today by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 1532.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you have Senate Bill 1532 before you, which is a committee bill. What it does is provide permissive language clarifying that centrally assessed property may be exempt under an enterprise zone agreement. We also have a dash 3 amendment that has been put together. During your hearing in January, you had a discussion of LC 22. This is a modified version of that. It makes some significant changes that will be discussed. The other thing I put in your packet for the bill is the temporary rule. The Department of Revenue had sent you this a couple of weeks ago, and I've just copied it for your convenience. It's a temporary rule defining data transmission services that was issued on January 25th.
Okay, Representative McLean has joined us. Would you like to testify by yourself or bring someone with you?
If I thank you, Mike McLean, representing House District 55. If I could have Corey Owens from Facebook up here. Chair Burdick and members of the committee. I have introduced into the House Bill 4067, and the dash 3 amendments that are before you today, excuse me, I've reviewed and am in favor of, and I think those can be more explained or better explained by Mr. Owens, and we'll be seeking to make this change in the House Revenue Committee for House Bill 4067. And I just renew my request that the committee pass Senate Bill 1532 for the reasons I stated previously. Thank you.
Thank you. Corey?
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Corey Owens, and I manage state public policy for Facebook. I am here today to offer Facebook's hearty support for Senate Bill 1532 and specifically for the Dash 3 amendment that was referenced by LRO staff. We believe that the Dash 3 amendment, which replaces the original text of 1532, reflects 3 months of careful negotiations with the governor's office, the data center industry, members of this committee, and members of other affected industries. We believe the Dash 3 amendment provides the certainty needed for data center operators to continue making investments in Oregon and generating jobs here in Oregon. We also believe that the Dash 3 amendment is carefully crafted enough that we can avoid impacting ongoing litigation and without interfering with the larger debate that many have encouraged be delayed until 2013. And so we believe that the Dash 3 amendment is elegant, if I can say that, and is also good public policy, and we would encourage this committee to act, given the time sensitivity of a number of the projects that are outstanding in the state of Oregon. We would encourage this committee to act swiftly on the Dash 3 amendment.
Thank you very much. Other questions from the committee? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
Tim McCabe and Jill Miles from Business Oregon.
Good morning, Chair Burdick, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Tim McCabe, Director of the Oregon Business Development Department, Business Oregon. With me is Jill Miles. She's our National Recruitment Officer. Jill is the person that was responsible, that worked with the site selection company for over a year that helped to bring Facebook to Oregon. So Jill is very knowledgeable on the importance of these incentives when it comes to recruiting companies to our great state. As Mr. Owen stated, we're here in support of 1532. The key that Mr. Owen stated, certainty. There cannot be uncertainty around this when we're recruiting these companies. They need to know how much it's going to cost them to locate in the state and how much it's going to cost them for the next 20 years, particularly a business like Facebook. So this bill and these amendments give that certainty to this incentive on the local level. So we're here in support of it, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I have a question. These are very high electricity users, and there are some states that compete actively with Oregon for these operations. How do Oregon's electricity rates compare to other states that are in the mix in terms of competing with us?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, that's a very good question. It's we're very competitive, but it depends on where you locate in the state. In this instance, they located in Pacific Corp's service territory. Pacific Corp has the lowest rates in the state, with the exception of Idaho Power on our eastern coast, but they don't have the water over there or the other infrastructure necessary to locate these data centers. So the electrical rates are very, very important. And one of the great things about Pacific Corp, or one of the interesting things, is they own their own mine mouth generation, so they're able to keep their rates low. They have their own generation, their own coal mines, and their own transmission lines. So that's how they keep the rates stable and low.
And you mentioned water. What point were you making on water?
I'm going to defer to Jill on that one. She's much more knowledgeable on the water.
All right. Thanks. Chair Burdick, for the record, I'm Jill Miles. I'm with Business Oregon as their national recruitment officer. Depending on the technology for the type of data center, some of them are significant water users. While technology changes on a regular basis and improves over time, we have found in working with these industries, water is important to help with the cooling. But the good thing that Oregon has going for it is that we have the climate, which is a nice complement to the water needs in order to run these facilities efficiently.
In other words, it's not too hot.
Correct.
Okay. Other questions from the committee? Thank you
Thank
for
you.
Thank
coming.
You.
Okay. Mike Dewey. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Mike Dewey for the record, representing the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association companies, including Charter, Wave, Ben Broadband, Comcast, and others. As I think you know, cable companies today are currently centrally assessed, and we've been working with Facebook on the amendments, and we're pleased that we're getting very close, and we think at the end of the day we can say that this bill is not going to be opposed by the OCTA. And I say that because all of these companies are actually competing with each other today in one way or another. And since cable companies are centrally assessed, and I think you know that is in litigation, Comcast prevailed at the Oregon Tax Court, appealed by the Department of Revenue, so Comcast is at the Supreme Court waiting for a decision. And hopefully the court will illuminate some more about what the 1973 statute says, albeit I think we need to fix that statute, because we don't want to be in a situation where we have companies that perhaps to have different technologies but compete with each other are taxed differently. And as I think you know, under central assessment, in many cases, the tax bill goes up significantly, and that's why this bill is of interest to Facebook and others. There were two amendments that we sought, and we were working with Facebook and others on those amendments, and we think that is now taken care of. The first was there was a provision originally in the proposal that if you met the, if you will, the conditions of the contract within the zone as a data center, you might be exempt from forever, and we didn't think that was appropriate. The other was the treatment of property that might compete with cable companies and others outside the zone. And now we have this 95-5 test. I won't go into the details of that. But that has been narrowed significantly. So we don't believe at the end of the day a company that wanted to, for example, set up a wireless center outside the zone clearly would be centrally assessed under the rules today, would be exempt from centrally assessment. So that was a concern, but that's been fixed. So with that, we're not opposed to this legislation. So I just want to put that on the record.
Mike, on your court decision, and I haven't read the decision that came down from the tax court, does that address all the issues that you wanted to have resolved, or was it narrower?
Madam Chair and members, I think the tax court wanted to look at it based on the facts of what Comcast is in its current condition as a business. At the end of the day, albeit there was a discussion about internet and data services, the court ruled on predominant use, and the company's predominant business was a video business and not a data business under the circumstances that exist today. But having said that, we have a new rule that defines a temporary rule, emergency rule, that defines what data service is that really hasn't been vetted by anyone. And that's why I think it's important because, again, this is a 73 statute. The vast majority of the companies that are coming under central assessment, and, again, your tax bill can go up hugely, didn't exist in 1973. We did, but in a different form. So it was fairly narrow on the predominant use.
Well, at risk of having my entire committee run for the hills, I will tell you that this is going to be a major project for us during the interim.
I understand that.
I think I'll be running for the hills as well. Okay, thank you. Other questions from the committee?
Thank you,
Mike. Gail Riddell.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. Four quick points to make. First of all, I want to relay high praise that Crook County gives to Facebook as a corporate citizen. They're behaving as though they're committed, and they are well appreciated as a citizen of Crook County. Second, I've sent off the -3 amendments to assessors to have them take a look in terms of its implementation, but that in no way should slow down whatever actions you wish to take. If there is a glitch of that type, we can take care of it. Third, we've gotten assurance that this language does not affect the Comcast appeal, so we're fine with that, and I'm glad to hear that. And we are looking forward to the interim discussion, and we'll try to go up in the hills and bring you back if we need to. The statutes do need some clarity. We agree with that, and we're looking forward to talking about it.
Thank you very much. Questions? We're not going to be able to move this bill today because we don't have the fiscal, so if you get any red alerts from the assessors on the technical aspects of it, please let Paul know right away.
Very good. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay. That's it. All right. Anybody else want to testify on this? Okay. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1532. And we're going to carry it over to Wednesday because we do not have a fiscal impact statement on the amendment. Okay. Now we will move to... Where's your agenda? I lost mine. As soon as I find my agenda. Here we go. Now we'll move to a public hearing on Senate Bill 1530. Paul.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1530 is also a Senate Finance and Revenue Committee bill that you introduced in January. It is a part of the revenue core system changes the Department of Revenue has been working on. This would essentially be a piece of establishing the framework for the department for setting up a revenue technology modernization fund that would be part of a negotiating process to develop a performance contract with a vendor that would work on the core systems replacement project. We do have the Senate Bill 1530 in front of you. We have been working closely with Department of Revenue. We do have an amendment. We have not gotten back yet. on this. It doesn't really change the basic scope. The amendment does change some of the wording in it, which I think is important in terms of understanding what the bill does. The main change that the amendment does is the original bill uses the term increased revenue from the project. This the amendment would change that to the amount that revenue exceeds the baseline developed by the department, and that's a real critical element to this, and the department will describe that for you. The other thing that the amendment does is it removes the Section 4 of the bill, which is the notwithstanding the expenditure limitation essentially with a blank. That is removed because this project, as you know, has been delayed in terms of the funding part until 2013. But nonetheless, this would be a piece of setting up the framework for the department to develop the project. And we do have our director here, Karen Gregory, and Eric Smith here to talk about it.
Okay, Ms. Gregory, thank you for coming. And tell us more about this.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Karen Gregory. I'm the acting director at the Department of Revenue, and I'm pleased to be here today to talk with you about our core systems replacement project and Senate Bill 1530 and why the passage of that bill is so important. So today we'll talk about our core systems. We'll talk about a comprehensive tax system and what that's all about, the risks of not replacing the system soon, and why we need Senate Bill 1530. So today, here's a picture of our core systems as we have them today. They were state-of-the-art for their time, and they were all developed by our in-house staff. They did a dynamite job of developing the processing systems, which is exactly what we asked them to do. As you can see from this picture, we have 80 major systems and another 200 satellite systems. Our business demands today more than just doing a great job of processing income tax returns. We have to find more advanced ways to collect additional revenue that taxpayers honestly owe, and we need data and management reporting systems to enhance the effectiveness of the work we do. We also need to respond in a more nimble way to the needs of business and to legislative requests. Just to give one example, in the past, DOR paid the fees to the private collection agencies for the accounts that they collected. Recently, we were able to shift these costs to the taxpayers, but it took us over 5 months to actually get the changes all worked through our systems. Because of all these systems, it takes a very long time to do a lot of the testing that needs to occur. So some of the delay was due to the staff resourcing, but much of it was due to that testing time. So with the new systems, our changes will be made swiftly. Testing will still occur, but as you will see, the new system will be quite streamlined. So our current systems were built over time. They responded to the business needs exactly as we needed them to do at that time. They don't communicate well because they were added on over time. They're inefficient to operate because of multiple applications and user interfaces and so many connections to other systems. Testing takes substantial time. Data management is unnecessarily complex. The master data is stored in a relational database, but the data has to move between the applications because of the complex architecture. Currently, it can take days to investigate and resolve taxpayer issues or inquiries because the data simply is not easily accessible. And our own COBOL developers who developed all of those systems are nearing retirement, and finding resources elsewhere in an aging programming language is quite difficult. So here is our comprehensive tax system. The system is fast. It's a vertically aligned integrated tax system. They have implemented systems successfully in 24 other taxing districts. That includes 16 states, some Canadian provinces, Trinidad, and other taxing jurisdictions. Every project they have been engaged in has come in on schedule and on budget, which of course gives a low risk of failure to Oregon. If you collapse these system elements, they connect and fit neatly into a well-defined unit. The bottom section is the system infrastructure, which is basically the hardware and the software. The next level comprises all the tax functions, the auditing, the collections, and so on. The next level is the interactive piece, how DOR will receive and send information to various parties. And then the workload level is the staff piece. It's how their workloads are actually displayed and managed. And finally, that top layer is the information data warehouse and reporting level. The integrated system is commercial off the shelf, and it will meet the needs, and it can be deployed quickly. The system will replace all of our income tax systems. It's a single source of data in a data warehouse rather than multiple systems as we have today. We will have regular updates with 16 other states on this system and fast working closely with all of the states on their systems to develop updates that address developing needs in revenue departments. Oregon will be able to be a part of that continuous updating process. We actually have 1,292 requirements, and FAST meets a very high percentage of those, about 94%. So FAST will increase compliance and revenue. It will help us improve customer service. We'll increase efficiency, and income tax administration will be much more flexible. So what's the risk of not replacing our systems? Well, there's the opportunity cost of lost revenue. The longer we wait to implement, the more revenue is actually left on the table. Our maintenance costs are increasing. Some of our senior programming staff are eligible to retire. Changes to the current system are complex and convoluted to complete. Getting business data out is very complex, and it's a manual process. Large amount of resource is needed to simply sustain basic service. Service expectations are very high. They're high from you. They're high from the taxpayers. Our partners are growing and wanting to have a system that is flexible in terms of accommodating information. And today, if we want to change our systems, it takes a lot of workarounds in order to make that happen. We have excellent staff, and they truly struggle to deliver in a timely manner. So without solid data analytics, maximizing collection for non-compliant taxpayers is quite difficult. So what we expect from a new system? We expect all income tax systems will be replaced, and that we expect that over 50% of our total systems will be replaced. We're going to have a return on investment of anywhere from $125 million to $315 million over the first 8 years. The full system implementation will take 5 to 7 years, and there will be some revenue lift in the next biennium, in the 1350 biennium. Now, you might ask, why is that return on investment a range? And it's a big range, $125 million to $315 million. And a lot of that has to do with some policy decisions that the department will be bringing forward to you during the interim. A couple of those have to do with, today we have garnishments that have to be signed manually. We do about 75,000 garnishments a year. If those can be done electronically through the system, they're done much faster and they don't sit on people's desks. So there are just a number of policy decisions like that that we'll come to you with. So where are we with the project? We are in contract negotiations with the vendor. We're working very closely with the State Procurement Office and Department of Justice. FAST is agreeable to continue negotiating with us on this contract with a delayed implementation to 2013, and they understand that the approval for this project will come from the legislature at that time. This is important because of all the work and resources invested not only by DOR, but by the Department of Justice, by DAS Procurement and EISPD, as well as LFO over the last 2 years, and all of that information will be used. We'll not need to reissue an RFP, and the ramp up for the new procurement process, we will not have to go through that. All of the work that has been done will be able to be used and will remain viable. All of the cost and revenue numbers are from FAST's original proposal. We're negotiating all of the terms in the next few months, and we'll have a much more solid picture of exact costs, the exact implementation timeline, and the revenue lift expectations. And again, they have completed every implementation on time and on budget. So that gives you a little foundation to our core systems and why we think they are so important. And Senate Bill 1530 is the vehicle to allow us to pay for that. And Eric Smith is with me, and he'll handle that portion.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Eric Smith, and I'm the manager of our program management office at the Department of Revenue. When we began looking at this project, 2 years ago, and we're getting ready for the 2011 session, and thinking about how we'd procure the system, it was signaled to the department pretty clearly that it was probably not going to be likely that we'd get an appropriation for the amount of funding that we'd need for a project like this. And so one method that revenue departments around the country have been engaging in is called a benefits-based or performance-based contract, where you're able to bring in a system, the vendor pays for the system up front, and then as the system is installed and it's proven to perform, after you've developed some baselines for what your historical performance has been, you will go ahead and then pay the vendor out of revenue lift that's realized after their new system is in. And what Senate Bill 1530 does is establish the mechanism for us to be able to do that by establishing a technology modernization fund. The director will be allowed to take receipts from those incremental revenues that are over the baselines, place them into the fund, and pay for vendor costs and pay for eligible department costs. The department also realizes additional costs for a project like this as well. We don't always do a large system implementation, and so we need to hire third-party experts who do have experience doing large IT implementation projects, particularly with regard to project management. We also need to have a quality assurance vendor. We also need to pay for independent validation and verification. And so these are expenses that are over and above our normal operating expenses that we'd expect to be eligible costs that we would also pay for out of this fund. The fund would revert to the general fund once all those expenses are met. And revenues, as I said, that exceed baselines go into the fund. And we will give annual reports to the legislature with regard to what funds were placed into that technology modernization fund and then what expenditures were paid for out of that fund. And the reason why we need Senate Bill 1530 now, as Director Gregory had mentioned, though we have deferred asking for the funding approval until next session, we are currently in contract negotiations with Fast Enterprises. And one of the things that would be very helpful for the department is to know that we do have the mechanism in place as we enter those negotiations. The department is ready. We successfully executed the procurement process and have received very good feedback from DOJ and SPO with regard to how successful this project has been. Fast Enterprises has been a very respected vendor in our community and the workspace for revenue agencies around the country. We've toured two other states who have implemented the Gentech system that Fast implements. And so we think that we have a low-risk vendor in this project, and we don't want to lose them. And again, execution, even though we would enter into negotiations and agree to a contract, execution of the contract would be contingent to funding approval in the 2013 session during the department's budget process. So approving Senate Bill 1530 now would put us, as I said, in better negotiating position, signals to FAST that Oregon is serious about engaging them in this contract. It assures that the funding mechanism is ready. It'll give us one less thing to do in the 2013 session. And as I said, it reduces the risk of losing this vendor. You know, the state and the vendor has put a lot of time and effort and cost into this procurement process. And everything we can do to wrap up this procurement process and be ready for implementation in 2013 is just one step further to get us ready. And at the end of the day, there's nothing to lose. If you pass this bill, and if in 2013 the legislature decides not to fund this project, there is absolutely nothing to lose from this bill. It can be repealed down the road. As Director Gregory mentioned, there are some interim policy discussions that we will be bringing forward to you as we continue to learn from this vendor about how we can maximize the use of their system as it automates some of the processes we do manually and makes us more efficient. One of the things that we're learning from other states who have engaged this Gentech system is that this will give us the opportunity to contact more taxpayers, to have a more active enforcement presence in the community. And to do that, we'll need to look at things like, right now we have wet signatures for garnishments to be able to send those out automatically. We have to send garnishments out with certified mail. And if we could do that through regular mail, that would speed things up and also save the state in terms of cost. So those are just a couple of examples of the types of policy changes that are in statute now that we would need to bring forward to you. I guess one last thing that I would say is that there needs to be an understanding that as the department has the opportunity to contact and engage in more compliance efforts with the taxpayers who are non-compliant, that you're probably going to hear more about that as the department is contacting more taxpayers than we currently do today. And so we would just need to know that this is a partnership with you and that we have your support as we move forward to improve our business processes and take advantage of the new technology that we'd be acquiring. Madam Chair.
With this system, if everything stays on track and it gets funded in 2013, how soon will we be able to match the federal returns with state taxpayers to make sure that people who should be filing are filing?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we've been doing that for years. We currently do that right now, and so we are able to do that. What we'll be able to do is to possibly do that more swiftly, and there are a number of different tapes that the IRS distributes, and we may be able to use more of those tapes and have a more effective way of matching returns, but we do currently match federal IRS tapes with our state returns.
Because the Secretary of State did a study and found out that there were literally thousands that hadn't been matched and were, you know, not appropriate. Is this a policy change within the department that you started doing it after that audit? Because I didn't think it was being done before the audit.
Go ahead. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I have not been directly involved in that. I know that we did look at that report, and we did make some enhancements to our non-filer program. I think we increased our staff level. I also think that when we looked at the types of accounts that the Secretary of State had identified, that there were a vast number of accounts that actually were not Oregon residents, were not actually eligible for us to send a tax notice. So we did do a lot of work with that, and I think we made some minor enhancements to improve our effort, but we had been doing quite a bit of work already using the federal data.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Telford.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you may not have the answer, but if I could get the answer to this question, it would be great. Is this fund a restricted fund, committed, assigned? I mean, is it a restricted or unrestricted fund, number one? And number two, within the fund then, how do we determine the savings that should go into that fund based on the software and the savings that should go into the general fund eventually, because they're just normal department savings. And but again, how? And I don't know if you know that answer. I apologize. That's a CPA a question, mostly pursuant to GASB 54.
Right.
And as we implement that, and we are continuing to struggle a little bit with how we denote those various funds, that would be, I think, be helpful to me.
Madam Chair, Senator Toffler, actually, we're working on baselines right now that will, and we have a company who has done this nationwide for benefits-based companies. We're developing the baseline of what we collect today, and given inflation over the next number of years, given our systems today, what we would expect to collect over this next 5 to 7 years, and then anything over and above that that has to do with the system, those are the dollars that will go into this fund. The vendor will get paid from the fund, and they will only get paid from those dollars that are over and above the baseline. And it will determine through negotiations what that percentage is. So let's say in 13-15, $100,000 goes into it just for numbers. So perhaps, and I don't know where the negotiations are, where we're at, but perhaps 75% of whatever the uplift is, the vendor gets as a portion of their payment for the system. The Department of Revenue is going to have costs, so perhaps the department gets 10% of that, and then the balance would go to the general fund. So basically, the vendor will get paid out of the uplift numbers, or the uplift dollars. The Department of Revenue will have costs for the system in terms of backfilling positions, in terms of quality assurance. Mr. Smith mentioned third-party contractors to help us out. So those costs will get paid for out of this fund, and the balance will go to the general fund.
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, we'll find out in terms of your question about the restricted fund or not. And did you say GASB 54? Yeah. I'm not. I know we worked with Ledge Council, and we've been working with Legislative Revenue. And so we'll make sure we understand and can answer your question for you with regard to the nature of that fund and whether it's restricted or not. The premise for this was based on what we did for the amnesty program and separating the fund from the general funds so that we could have those revenues available to pay the vendor and pay for this, the department's expenditure.
Follow up, please. Well, and I think the amnesty is a perfect example. Whether those funds really need to be in the general fund, once we paid the $1 million, I'm seeing we're still using amnesty funds. And should they have not been unrestricted to begin with and gone to the general fund. So my concern is, obviously, the methodology and the model that we use that's going to hold dollars into a fund that is probably unrestricted that really should be going into the general fund to be paying for vital services to Oregonians and the like. So, again, very interested in how we determine what dollars stay there, and are those dollars restricted or unrestricted, with all the little definitions involved in both those major definitions.
But the alternative would be to have to pay the vendor up front, right? Doesn't the vendor have to see some kind of sequestering to defray their payment?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes. The alternative would be for you to appropriate for us to be able to fund and pay for the vendor, correct?
I don't have a problem with that, but are the only funds in that fund to go to the vendor then?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, once we understand what the total cost of the project will be, I imagine in 2013 we'll have a total not to exceed figure, including department costs.
Okay, so anything in that fund, it does include department costs.
Right, so again, anything in that fund,
it isn't just to pay
that,
the vendor. Got it.
Nope. Yeah, anything over that.
Yeah, okay.
The question, Senator Morris.
Thank you. I have a number of questions, if I may.
Please.
Madam Chair. Have we done a comparative analysis between an outright purchase contract and this benefits contract to know what the cost is? It appears to me this is just strictly a financing, an alternative financing mechanism, and I assume that it's because we don't have the money to do it.
Madam Chair,
what's that cost to the failure of managing our fiscal affairs? Mm-hmm. Do we know what that cost is?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, we did not do a study to understand what that cost would be. You are correct. A vendor is going to be paying for their own risk premium for front-loading the cost on something like this. They'll be paying for their cost of capital, though those costs are lower these days. We would have had to do two separate procurement processes to know what those costs would have been. And when we knew that the likelihood of us having an outright purchase by an appropriation from the legislature for that was not likely, that's what we had heard about 18 months ago, we only designed our procurement process for a benefits-based procurement.
What is the approximate cost for just an outright purchase?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, that is a very complex question depending on the tax programs that a state like Oregon might have compared to, say, other states. Fast Enterprises is in 16 other states. Most of those other states have sales tax programs, and some of those states run their DMV or Liquor Control Commission, and so it's very difficult to have an apples-to-apples comparison about the cost.
Let me interrupt. Are you trying to get at what the difference in cost would be with an appropriation versus this other method?
Yes.
Yeah. So what's the difference?
It's strictly a financing mechanism.
Correct.
It's an alternative to what would be conventional, and what I would be interested to know is what is the difference between the two, and it seems that we should know that. from a you might say a priority prioritization process. Because our cost of capital has to be much less than conventional commercial financing.
Right. Madam Chair, Senator Morris, we actually don't have that information. The only RFP we put out was for benefits-based, and we did that because we knew that we wouldn't be able to get... We assumed that we were going to do implementation this biennium, and we knew that there was going to be no dollars. So we do not have an exact figure on what it would cost if the state were to fund this from the up front.
Okay, thank you. One more question.
Please.
Would the... savings, anticipated savings, be calculated by our state economist in his revenue forecasting?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, we will have many partners with us as we're working through the process in terms of the revenue uplift and implementation and so on. So the answer is yes. We'll also have LRO and LFO partnering with us as well.
So would I conclude then that if these savings are included in the forecast, it would not compound a kicker calculation in the future?
Madam Chair, Senator Morrison, with all due respect, I'm not sure that we've talked about how the forecast will be impacted with this, and that's not something that is our area of expertise, at least in my area where we're implementing the project. So that's a question I think that still needs to be answered, and I'm not sure if staff can help with that.
Senator Morrison, I think the key for the forecast is the baseline, because the baseline will be designed to try to reflect other factors that influence the forecast that are not related to the project. So there'll be an estimate of what the project would bring in, and then there would be an estimate of what revenue would be without the project. So in effect, you'll have it would be like any other piece of legislation that would be built into the forecast as a separate calculation.
But isn't it true that to the extent that funds are sequestered into this other fund, that would take it out of any calculation for the forecast?
Madam Chair, yes. If this is set up as a separate and distinct from the general fund, you'll have an estimate of what dollars will go into that, but that would not be part of the general fund calculation for purposes of the kicker.
More?
Can I express frustration?
Yes, you may, Senator Morris. You can say something about railroads, too, if you want.
No, I won't say anything about railroads, but I applaud your efforts. Obviously, we need an upgrade. But to the extent that we manage our financial affairs, that we cannot take care of core business. This is absolutely core business. We cannot finance it. And it gets back to, again, our lack of having meaningful stability funds for critical needs as they emerge, and we just run to the edge, and now we go into some kind of an alternative financing mechanism, and we don't know what it's going to cost us compared to a conventional way of operating procurement, and that just bothers me.
Do you think that you could get the information from the company on what it would cost if we were able to get an appropriation? I think that, excuse me, I think that'd be useful information to have.
Madam Chair, we're in contract negotiations now. It's certainly a question we can ask.
Yeah, and I'm sure, yeah, if we could manage to do it that way, I'm sure it would be cheaper, and I'm sure it wouldn't be something the company would oppose, certainly.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the one concern that I've heard about that is because the procurement process that we laid forth was for benefits-based, we may have to do a completely new procurement process if we were to go for an outright procurement. And so that's just a legal question for the attorneys who help us with the procurement process.
No, yeah, what we're trying to get at is not to have you go through another process, but to just get at least a ballpark of what the difference in cost would be with an upfront.
Madam Chair, we will do what we can, and we'll work with Department of Justice to make sure that we're staying within the lines of, you know, the procurement law. And we'll get whatever information we can back to you.
That's good for you.
I realize you've said that there are 16 other states that have done this, and so there is some track record involved. But I can't believe that when you calculate, and from a business standpoint, if I'm providing this service to you, I'm calculating a lot of risk into this equation, because it's a public-private partnership and certain people have certain things to do, and there's risk involved in this, and that risk is built into the cost of the project. And the benefits, you know, accrue to the provider, the one that puts up the money. And to not know what that delta is between the two alternative systems, I think is...
there's a question you probably should have been asked by Ways and Means as well.
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, we don't know what this vendor has asked. We do have an expert who's been helping us with the benefits-based process, and their estimate, it's not exact, their estimate is generally vendors would have 15% to 20% in terms of a risk premium they would add on to something like this, but we don't know specifically, because we didn't do the two procurement processes, what this particular vendor is charging us. But historically, that's what their experience is, if that helps you, Senator Morse.
And then, Madam Chair, the scope of the project, I mean, just generally speaking, how much money will the contractor invest to get us up to the standards that we're asking for in our contract negotiations?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, the cost of the system is anywhere between $39 and $69 million. And the reason that there's a spread is that right now we're in contract negotiations. This is based on the proposal that they gave us as an answer to the RFP. So it depends on whether we add an imaging system and so on. So it really, there are pieces that can get added that will take it from the 38 to the 69 million. So right now it's the range that we have. The good news is that the payback on that is at a minimum $125 million.
And that's total for 8 years, 5 to 8 years? That's...
Madam Chair, yes, that's correct.
Senator Telford.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, just a comment is that aside from the risk and the profit margin that's being built in, just the time value of money. I mean, obviously the interest charge, because they're financing this over a period of time, is probably much higher than it would be with public funds being borrowed or whatever. The question I had, though, is, so we're sequestering this money for their sake so that they feel more safe that they're going to get paid. I mean, this isn't for our benefit. This is definitely for their benefit. My concern is, if, in fact, these monies are committed and not legally restricted, do they not know that the legislature could redeploy them at their whim? I mean, again, that's why it's important for me to know what kind of funds these are and the funds that you know, continually grow in there. How, you know, what's the flavor of these funds? Because there may be no guarantee that these funds won't be redeployed by the legislature in 2 years. So, but again, this my sense is that this is strictly the vendor wanting to be guaranteed that there's going to be money there to pay the vendor, and then the issue of what's the vendor charging us in the time value of money versus, you know, is it 18%? Is it statutory? It's at 9? I mean, you know, really. I mean, this is expensive money. I get the sense.
Madam Chair, Senator Telfler, if I might, it's not just the vendor that is supportive of this bill being passed this session. And the reason for that is the department's very interested in it, and it's not just for the partnership. What we're hoping is that we'll be able to get an early approval in Ways and Means in 2013. And if this bill is passed now and we actually have the funding mechanism, then we can begin implementation early. And the earlier we begin implementation in the next biennium, the sooner dollars start flowing into the fund. And not only does the vendor get paid, but there's some revenue uplift that potentially goes to the general fund in 13-15 as well. So I don't want to leave you with the impression that the only reason we're bringing this bill forward is to give the vendor comfort. What we're really trying to do is to be well situated for the passage of an approval in 2013 for doing core systems and to get that ball rolling just as fast as we can.
Well, it's an earmark so that the money doesn't go to the general fund and pay for K through 12, et cetera. I mean, that's really what it is. It's setting aside and protecting it. It's almost like protecting against a sweep or something like that. So, okay, thank you.
If something happened, and I don't know, and you can tell we're revenue, we're not ways and means, so this is probably a really dumb question, but was the issue of bonding ever suggested as a possible way to fund this?
Madam Chair, actually the department did talk about bonding at one point. Mm-hmm. And because this is software, my understanding is you can bond for hardware and things, but when you are talking about software, bonding is really not an option.
Do you have something to add, Paul? Okay. All right. Thank you. this has been very helpful. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Is there anybody else? Oh, yes, there is. Any other questions first? Okay. Thank you. We have signed up Peggy Woolsey.
Good morning, Senator Burdick and esteemed committee. I just found out last night that I would be possibly testifying on this, so my preparation has not been really deep. I still have many friends at the Department of Revenue where I worked for 31 and a half years, and I had concerns from them brought forward to me, and they asked me to represent them. From our IT section, I have a letter, and I'll read you the letter. It says, "Dear legislators, I read the Statesman Journal article on January 12, 2012 about the Department of Revenue's computer core system replacement that's to cost up to $92 million, aside from the $6 million that they've already spent on setting it all up. My concern about this is at a time when the agencies are cutting services to Oregonians, a state agency should not be spending dollars to fund a new system when the current system is working well enough. The new system is just a reinvention of what we've already put in place with a price tag of $92 million initially. I say initially because the cost of ownership is not reflected in the price tag. I propose scrapping the core system replacement project and instead enhance the current system using in-house resources. Revenue has a pool of talented IT professionals who are very capable of improving the system for a fraction of the cost of replacing it. Using in-house talent also ensures that the business knowledge is already there as opposed to outside contractors who have to learn our business. Many revenue employees have submitted to management suggestions on how to improve not just the system but also the business processes. But suggestions have not been implemented, giving the reason that the new system will do all of that for us. Given that the new system will be implemented in 7 years, I think management decision not to improve what we can right now is a waste of time and dollars. In February, the Senate Bill 1530 will come up for session. I question the state of the emergency declaration in Section 6. I also have concerns as well regarding this bill, which I would be willing to discuss. I respectfully urge you to oppose this bill as there is no state of emergency to the public's peace, health, and safety. On the contrary, approving this bill would drain the state of money it doesn't have." That was presented to me by one person who works in the IT section, and she had the input of several other people working in IT.
Did you want to submit that for the record?
I certainly could, certainly. And then I took notes after talking to several other Department of Revenue employees. From auditors and collectors, I received the information that they've had the ability to make judgment calls in their work taken away from them. Many of the senior collection personnel that what are known as the revenue agent threes have not been allowed to go out and collect to the best of their ability. And it seems to all of them that the bar is being lowered for what current revenue can be brought in to make it a better deal for the contractor in taking a percentage of what they can increase the revenue by. Other concerns that were brought forward to me was that there was not enough oversight of the contractors. There's no provision for increases in revenue that we could produce over and above what the new computer could produce. It leaves open payment to contractors for each project, and they believe it's premature that the project may not be approved in 2013. And another person brought forward the information that FAST does not yet have a data storage capability yet, that they would have to develop that at the same time that they're developing our system. From another couple of people, I had other information that there was, over the past 3 years, when we were spiraling down in the economy, they were taking 6 to 8 full-time positions and devoting it to the planning stage for this computer, that there were 6 to 8 contractors that were working at $250 per hour. And there were numerous other people all over the agency that involved in the planning for this. At the same time, we were leaving over 100 positions open that were direct revenue-producing positions. So it seems like at the worst time in our economy, we've not done the best job that we could in bringing in more dollars with what we had available. And I'm sorry I don't have more information for you at this time. This was all brought together so quickly.
Thank you very much.
You're
questions
welcome.
From the Paul?
Madam Chair, and members of the committee, just one comment about the -1 amendments, which I apologize we don't have for you. But those amendments will eliminate the emergency clause because it's not because of the kind of different status of where the program is.
Okay. That's it. Or did you have any questions?
Any other questions? No, that's it.
Thank you so much.
All right. Anybody else want to talk on this? All right. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1530. We are waiting for an amendment, and after we get the amendment, this bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. So that will all happen at some future time. Should we just put this over? Is there a chance we'll get it on Wednesday?
Put it over.
So we'll move this bill over to Wednesday. Now, I'm very pleased to announce that we can actually open a work session on Senate Bill 1529. It's your bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we did get the fiscal impact statement on Senate Bill 1529, the -2 amendment. There is a finding of no expenditure impact on that fiscal impact statement. The other materials have been reviewed before the revenue impacts and all that you have before you on the -2 amendment. The measure would separate, as you know, the separate classes for machinery and equipment and some other types of properties. And the mechanism by which it would change revenue would be to change around the change price ratios that are calculated on just new properties. So this measure would not change around the price ratios on existing properties, but only on new improvements or brand new properties.
Okay. Senator Morse, this was your ideas. Do you have any comments on this?
Well, since we're in work session, Madam Chair, are you ready for a motion?
Yeah, I am. I am ready for a motion.
Okay. Madam Chair, I would move the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 1529 dated 2212.
Senator Morse has moved the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 1529. Is there any discussion? I just wanted to express my appreciation for the work group that's been working very hard on this. This is a very complex area, so we had business people and the assessors really were very helpful in this work group. So with that, is there any other discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Morse.
Madam Chair, I would move Senate Bill 1529 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morse has moved Senate Bill 1529 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. I wonder who we should have carry this. Senator Morse. Senator Morse will carry this.
Christine will help me.
Yes, Christine, don't stray far from the floor when this comes up. Okay, I think we've carried over what we need to carry over. And
we meet at 8:30.
Oh, committee.
Get
there's
sleep in.
Relief
really?
In sight. We meet at 8:30 on Wednesday. And we have some bills. That Wednesday, of course, is the forecast day. We have some bills that we will take up if we have time after the forecast, but if we don't, we'll put those over till Friday. And I think I'll take a look with Paul at what our workload is, but I think I'm going to make 8:30 a standard operating procedure for the committee. I think we can do that. So just be sure to check the agenda. Okay. Further business? We are adjourned. Adjourned. Further business? We are...